From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, it's not the first back-to-school time for Keith Posley, but it is his first as MPS superintendent. We'll hear about his ambitious plans for the district.
Later, why the life of a 19th century actor makes for compelling drama today.
Edwin Booth is alive at the time when photography is beginning, and he dies at the time that recording is beginning. So we are defining celebrity in America in brand new ways during his entire career.
And while Harley riders are celebrating the company's 115th anniversary, a Frenchman is riding a 100-year-old Harley to mark the anniversary of World War I's end.
It's a bit of the American dream on our French road. It's a culture, and I think Harley Davidson brings this American culture all over the world.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Keith Posley has been on the job as the interim superintendent of Milwaukee Public Schools since April, following the resignation of Darian Driver. But the sight of classes getting underway at MPS is nothing new for Posley. He's been with the district in various capacities for nearly 30 years.
Posley started as a teacher and was a principal for a time before moving into an administrative role. Already, he's laid out an ambitious course for the district, which has faced numerous challenges over the years. Lake Effect's Emily File sat down with Posley as the year was just beginning to talk about what lies ahead for the district and its leader.
What was your thinking behind that decision? You had just taken on the superintendent role and you made this major change. Why did you decide to do that?
I decided to do that because of children. This work is all about children for me and making sure that children are able to receive a quality education. And in order to do that, I needed to have teachers in classrooms and putting money into schools where our young people are.
What about the budget deficit in future years? Do you think there will need to be cuts to classrooms?
My goal is not to cut the classroom, because that's truly where the rubber meets the road for the learning process. And I'm going to do everything in my power to stay away from the classroom and stay away from cutting the classroom. Yes, we have situations with our budget that has been forecast, and we are right now working to make sure that for not only this year but years to come that we will have a balanced budget.
And what are some things that you have been thinking about, kind of long-term money-saving measures that the district could take that don't affect the classrooms directly?
Well, there's a number of different things that we could do, and number one is enrollment. Number one is to increase our enrollment, and that's something that we have undertaken this school year to do everything that we can to increase enrollment. We've been canvassing the neighborhood, knocking on doors, going to every location that you will find parents and children to make sure that we enroll young people.
So enrollment, you're counting on enrollment to go up to help the financial situation.
Absolutely.
And how can you do that? I mean, you went door to door. People in the district went door to door this summer trying to boost enrollment. But the reality is that there are so many options for Milwaukee area students. So how do you make MPS really a much more attractive option that results in the amount of an increase in enrollment that you would need to really help the budget?
We have to be the first and the best option that's in this city that this city has to offer. And we're doing everything to make sure that is the soundbite that everyone get an opportunity to hear, and also to be able to tell our story of the great things that happen on a daily basis in the Milwaukee Public Schools.
So you've said that your focus is going to be on strengthening the fundamentals, reading, writing, and math. Did you have a specific experience in your career as an educator and administrator that made you think that that is the path to success for a school district like MPS?
Yes, and I will start by saying my experience at Clark Street School, as principal of Clark Street School. We were a 90-90-90 school, 90% attendance, 90% poverty, and 90% proficiency. And it was simple. It was this whole thing around math, reading and writing at mastery levels with fidelity of implementation every single day. And also in the, like for instance, for an example, in the area of reading, if a young person is receiving one block of reading, maybe they need two blocks of reading. And looking at this second block is more of an authentic reading piece where young people get a chance to explore and adventure, read about themselves, read about things that they are interested in, and just get a chance to see themselves through reading and look at reading from different ways and different lenses. We, this summer, have pulled together an ambitious instruction plan for the district. We looked at it through the lens of math, reading, and writing, pulled together the academic office, teachers from within the district, and a number of other administrators in the district to sit down to look at what ambitious instruction looked like in math, reading, and writing. We have pulled out high leverage strategies that we're going to implement with fidelity, with a laser focus. One of the things that I added into my organizational structure is a communication performance office to make sure that everything we do is driven by data. So we're constantly looking at data on a daily basis, and that's informing our decisions.
What is that going to look like for a student in a classroom? Is it going to mean more minutes in the day spent on those subjects or different ways that they're being taught? Special teachers coming in, what is that going to look like?
It's going to look all of the above, you know, and our goal is to make sure that our young people get what they need, and looking at individual growth plans for each one of our students. One student may need this and another student may need something totally different. Also getting that support, and were you talking about people coming in? Yes, we're asking that, you know, for instance, have a system of support. Everyone here at 52nd and Valete that's a part of the academic team will be visiting and working with young people in schools. If children are not reading and writing at proficiency levels, it's everybody's problem. It's not just the teacher's problem. It's not just the child's problem. It's all of our problems, and we're going to share in that together, and we're going to put that support around those young people to get them there and get them where they need to be. So it's going to be a multi-approach of coming at it from all different angles. And yes, I'm going to say that we're going to be shooting scores up overnight. Nothing happens overnight. But I assure you, with time on task and implementation with fidelity, we will see growth.
What kind of feedback have you been getting from teachers on that approach? Is there any fear from teachers who are not teaching those core subjects? Theater, art, PE, is there any fear that those are going to get pushed aside?
The overwhelming thing that I've heard from teachers is thank you. It's time that we zero in and focus on what matters and focus on what we need to do for young people.
So a recent Marquette poll shows that people in Wisconsin favor more spending on schools and that K-12 education is one of voters' top priorities. What do you think that will mean for MPS as the biggest school district in the state of Wisconsin?
It was very refreshing to hear and just to know this is something that I've known for a long time. This is not anything brand new to me. And I know a school is where it matters, schools is where it counts, and we have to invest in our schools. If we want a strong Milwaukee and a strong Wisconsin, it's going to start in our schools.
Are you hoping for more state funding for schools?
We would always welcome more state funding. And I'm hoping for any type of funding that's going to come our way that's going to meet the needs of young people.
2 weeks into the school year, what do you think your biggest challenges as interim superintendent are going to be?
I would say, number one, making sure that our children are in school every single day. Because every single day counts, and making sure that we're delivering high quality instructions every single day, from bell to bell, teaching.
Mm-hmm. And you announced this attendance campaign recently. So it seems like it's a big goal for you to get students who are chronically absent from school back in the classroom.
Right. We've got to get them there. You can't learn if you're not in school. You have to be there every single day. And so we're pushing our young people to be there every single day. I'm pushing on the community to help us to make sure children are there every single day. And if you see a young person, even yourself, Emily, if you see a young person out and about and you have a casual conversation with them, ask, why are you not in school today? Or either, shouldn't you be in school today? And encourage them along the way to please attend school every day.
There's the attendance campaign, there's the focus on the core subjects, and you've also announced this new initiative focused on the 53206 zip code. Mm-hmm. Are you worried about biting off more than you can chew?
No, I do it all the time. You can look at me and tell that I don't have a problem with biting off of a lot. And I think that our district and our young people deserve it all. And it's my responsibility to make sure they receive what's needed. And all over the city, it's a lot to be done, but I have a lot of great people, and no one travels this road alone.
In terms, going back to enrollment and the challenges around enrollment, do you have an opinion about whether MPS should expand its portfolio of charter schools and partnerships with charter schools, or do you think that takes away from enrollment at traditional schools?
No, we have a wonderful landscape of school communities here in the city of Milwaukee, and we have charter schools within our district, and we are very excited about that. And we're looking at market share, and we have charter schools as well as traditional schools, and we're all one family. We're all Milwaukee Public Schools, so we are excited about the whole idea of having charter schools in our portfolio.
Do you want to be permanent superintendent?
Wow, absolutely. I don't do this for dress rehearsal, you know, but I do this for young people. At the end of the day, this is all about young people. I'm giving it 110% every single day, and that's 7 days a week, trying to make a difference for young people. And I'm a firm believer, you do what you have to do, get the job done, and all of those things will fall in place for itself. So I'm about getting the work done and about making sure that young people have the same experiences that I had as a child and have the opportunity to truly live the American dream. And we know that is all possible with a quality, wholesome education. And that's our mission in the Milwaukee Public Schools, to give all of our young people, all 76,035 students, a quality, wholesome education that they can walk out of these doors and go and command the career that they want in life. And all of the things that I see on a daily basis make us MPS proud. And it's just, and I just encourage Emily, you and the listening audience, to please take time out of your busy schedule and visit one of the 160 schools of excellence in the Milwaukee Public Schools.
I would love to.
And I'll take you up on that offer.
Okay, Dr. Keith Posley, Interim Superintendent of MPS, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Keith Posley is Interim Superintendent of Milwaukee Public Schools. He spoke with WUWM's education reporter, Emily Files. You can hear other stories about Posley, MPS, and education as a whole at WUWM.com.
The life of 19th century actor Edwin Booth, brother of another famous Booth, comes to life on stage this weekend in Milwaukee. We'll hear more about the production and the life of Booth when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Many Milwaukee theatergoers have had the pleasure of seeing Angela Iannone act on local stages over the years. She's a talented, passionate, and consummate artist, and she brings those same qualities to her playwriting. Theater Red's production of her play, This Prison Where I Live, is currently on stage at the Theater Space in the Big Red Church on 10th and Wisconsin.
The play is one of four that Iannone has written about the great American actor Edwin Booth. Booth was one of the greatest actors of the 19th century and was immensely popular. He was also the brother of the more infamous John Wilkes Booth. After the assassination of President Lincoln and the subsequent death of John, Edwin Booth spent the rest of his life haunted by his brother's actions, even as his own fame was undiminished.
I sat down recently with Iannone and actors Corey Jefferson Hagen, who plays John Wilkes, and Jared McDerris, who plays Edwin. Iannone began by explaining the true story that inspired This Prison Where I Live.
This play is about one specific moment in time that absolutely fascinated me, and it's absolutely a real thing. In 1879, April 23rd, as a matter of fact, Shakespeare's birthday, Edwin was performing his production of Richard II at the McVicar Theater in Chicago. And the McVicar was owned by his father-in-law. His second wife was Mary McVicar. So he is performing this production of Richard II, and he gets to the Act 5 of his cut of the play, which is Richard II after he has been imprisoned and is trying to figure out his life. And he's talking about, I have been studying how I may compare this prison where I live unto the world. And he's literally in a prison, but he's also in a prison of his own making because his downfall as a king has been partly his own fault. At the moment where he is sitting on the bench and speaking this monologue, this was a moment when Edwin, the actor, was very, very still on stage. And Edwin was famous and infamous, for once he had set the blocking or the stage business, he never changed it. No matter how many years he played the role, the blocking was the same. It worked. He was comfortable with it. He remembered it. He wasn't going to change it. So he's sitting there speaking this speech, and an assassin fires two shots from the right balcony. Now, in those days, the lights in the theater were kept full up, so the house lights are on. These bullets, either one of them, should have killed him. But for some reason, in the split second before that first bullet hit the stage, Edwin stood up, which he had never done in that role ever before. He stood up. The bullet actually whiffed his wig and lodged in the set wall behind him. Then, instead of running away or ducking or something, he walked downstage and looked out into the audience. The assassin fired a second bullet, which should have hit him, but it didn't. It went right past him and lodged in the stage floor. At that point, he pointed out into the audience, shouted, "Arrest that man." Three random guys in the audience that were sitting around this assassin wrestled him to the ground. A third shot was fired into the ceiling of the theater while they were trying to disarm him. They carried him out of the theater. Edwin Booth calmed the audience and said, "We're going to take a little break. We'll start again in 15 minutes. And he walked off stage. He would never talk about why he moved. He would never explain it. People said, what prompted you to move? Why did you stand up? What was happening for you?" And he would never talk about it. This play is about why Edwin moved.
All right. So, my actors, talk a little bit about why Edwin moved without giving away too much.
It's okay.
Is it okay?
It is okay.
All right.
I think we can allow audiences to expect some things. I don't think we could give everything away even if we tried.
Okay.
There's too much in there. So by this point in time, John Wilkes has been dead for quite a while. So my appearance in this show is not exactly of this world. And so we get to play with the notion of Edwin Booth being a haunted man, which is a thing that's come up repeatedly in every Booth play that I've done with Angela through these years, all of her research. He was haunted, hung about with shades. So being able to play something or someone who is not there but is there has let a lot of this stuff that we don't have this information, so we can kind of expand upon it and go, well, maybe it's this thing. And this is, you know, what I'm doing is trying to steer him in the direction that he needs to go, even though, am I there? Am I not? Who knows? I do.
you're not there, but you never leave.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really important point
for Edwin.
For Edwin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That Johnny has been dead for a long time, but Johnny's always there.
Never, ever a chance to kind of like put that aside for you.
Yeah, that's a big thing in this play in particular is the constant presence. Edwin very much wants to be left alone, ostensibly to prepare or concentrate. But it's also worth pointing out that everyone who refuses to leave him alone is also challenging fairly deep underlying beliefs he has about how he needs to be behaving right now. And how he thinks he needs to be behaving right now is usually more based on his own misconceptions of what is right and wrong, or his own misconceptions on what is the society in which he lives dictates is right and wrong. I guess you could say decorum in some ways is dictating that. In fact, a lot of the play centers around these two estranged brothers, and obviously they have other things to argue about given why one of them is no longer around. But they have a lot of things to argue about, but the arc of their conflict, I guess I'll say, both begins and ends with John Wilkes challenging Edwin's acting style, or at least what his acting style has become at this point.
My understanding of the history is that when John Wilkes was alive, mm-hmm. the two of them had a very different approach to theater.
Yes, and the two of them had very different abilities. Edwin was a classical actor, and he was the gifted one. Johnny was beautiful. Johnny was not gifted in the classics. The bulk of his repertory was actually melodrama. We actually talk about it. One of his big hits was this play, melodrama play called The Corsican Brothers, and there have been several contemporary movies of it. It's really quite a lovely story and quite thrilling. And at that time, it was largely a big special effects drama with lots of fighting and agonized lovers. Really interesting script. That was one of Johnny's big hits. He wasn't good at Shakespeare, and he really wasn't a good actor. He was handsome and had physical ability and was a startling personality, just incredibly charismatic. But that's not really an actor. Edwin was the gifted one. I mean, in this particular play, there are two ghosts who are ever present for Edwin. The ghost of his first wife, Mary Devlin, who died in 1863, and the ghost of his brother, Johnny, who died in 1865. And both of them are with him for very, very different reasons. And he actually has better relationships with those two ghosts than he does with his current wife, Mary McVicker Booth, who was a drug addict and insane. And then there is the young man who comes to bug him in the theater and is a really annoying fan, and a dangerous fan. And I think even if one is not an actor, one is familiar with those scenarios where someone who becomes obsessed with a figure that they think an actor is and wants them to fulfill some task for them as a fan that is dangerous and frightening and unreasonable.
The whole stalking thing.
Very much a stalking thing. Yeah.
So pulling all of this together, this is number four in the trilogy? Is that
there
right?
There are four plays.
Yeah.
This one was written second. It takes place in 1879, which chronologically puts it after The Seeds of Banquo, which Theater Red produced in 2015.
And which we talked about.
Which we did talk about. Mm-hmm. So chronologically, this one is third in the four produced plays, but I wrote it second in the progression through the four current Booth scripts.
I guess what I'm trying to get at with that is that we're getting this amazingly complete picture of who Edwin Booth mm-hmm. was mm-hmm. through these scripts and through these particular things, even if, like in this play, what happened, we don't know what actually happened.
We do.
But we don't know why.
Yes. This is my why.
This is your why.
Mm-hmm.
And so why do we care about Edwin Booth still? Because we obviously do. People in theater, people even outside of theater who mm-hmm. are fascinated by this genius.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can give you my own thoughts about that.
And I want you guys to come in on
absolutely.
That, too.
Absolutely. I am using Edwin Booth as a skin through which I explore social issues, issues of art, questions of identity, gender identity, racial equality. I'm slipping into that skin, and I am looking at the historical facts about his life and the people that he knew, and finding ways to have conversations that interest me about all of those things. Because the 19th century is more like us than unlike us. All of the same issues that we are exploring right now, we were exploring in the 1800s, just in a slightly slower way of talking to each other about it because we didn't have the immediacy of social media. But Edwin Booth is alive at the time when photography is beginning, and he dies at the time that recording is beginning. So we are defining celebrity in America in brand new ways during his entire career. So the idea that a celebrity belongs to their public, the idea that people in the public eye should behave differently, might be held to different standards, might be tortured by that at the same time that that's their livelihood, so they can't walk away from it. Issues of gender. We have been doing cross-dressing in America since the late 1700s. And by 1825, there had already been a female Hamlet on the New York stage. But it was looked at with a lot of side eye. Like, what are these women doing? Why aren't they content with playing in skirts or playing roles that define their femininity in a certain way? Well, we were exploring those same things in the 19th century and beginning to say, no, I want to play some men's roles because the women's roles don't satisfy me. And people like Edwin Booth are taking roles away from women wearing pants and saying, I would rather have a man do it because it makes me more comfortable. And at the same time as he's casting male witches in Macbeth. So how is gender performed? How comfortable are we with things crossing over? He's operating in the 1800s, which is an uncomfortable time for American history in terms of performing race. So many fabulous social, political things happen. Edwin Booth is at the center of almost all of it. Art, poetry, politics, and defining ourselves as Americans, because he was the first international classical star. He went over to England, and although they didn't like him much, the critics didn't like him, the audiences came and watched this American performing their Shakespeare. In a time when Americans are saying, well, we have every right to perform Shakespeare the way we want to, without an accent. He goes to Germany and is an enormous star performing in bilingual productions in Germany. He performed with the Italian tragedian Tommaso Salvini here in America. He performed all over the country, anywhere the railroad would go. And everyone connected with him. All of the women actor managers, all the women I've gotten to know that were an important part of American theatrical history that I was only able to find because of their connection with Edwin Booth, that because they were connected with him, somebody kept information, somebody kept a program, somebody wrote a bio, a critic showed up at a show. We should care about him because we can have conversations about things that were important to him are now still important to us. And looking through the lens of the past is sometimes easier because it puts it far enough away that we don't feel threatened and we're able to examine it in a slower way. And I think that the social strictures also help us, that there are manners and there are distances that you stand apart from people that you don't know, and there are ways that you treat the other gender that allow for surprising stage situations when those rules are broken. But when we see people in these clothes, we are expecting a certain kind of behavior. When that behavior is upset, we can spot that more easily.
Do either of you have anything to jump in on that with?
Oh, there was so much in there. I don't know what more I can add. I mean, besides the fact that Edwin Booth is interesting because he led us in the direction that we've moved in theater. We wouldn't have a dark house if it wasn't for Edwin Booth. You'd still have the lights up. There would be no distinction between the world that you're living in the play and the audience. So there are all these small things that we take for granted now that are thanks to him. So being able to look at all of this and go, okay, so yes, all of these things that Angela has just gone through, but also all of these small things that we think are so normal were not normal to him, but he made them normal, is incredibly interesting to me. And being able to go to her and be like, I have a question about this thing, and it doesn't matter where we're at. If it's in any way related to Edwin Booth, we can get her on a 30-minute to an hour-long tangent connected to literally everything and everyone he's ever worked with, and you walk out of it knowing more than you did before, and you're really pleased about it. Learning about Edwin and caring about Edwin just means that we're not giving up on the stuff that happened before. We're continuing to grow and expand upon it, and we're also learning about someone who is incredibly important in the world of theater and the world in general.
It's really talking about him as, a link to what was normal then versus what is normal now. And yeah, it is interesting, like you say, like Lights Out, for example, is normal now. But what I really appreciate is that like these revolutionary steps that he took were not necessarily considered normal for most of and sometimes the entirety of his career. Mm-hmm. And like the things that we consider revolutionary, like, you know, we're all raised on, I'll just say Disney movies, for example, where like somebody causes some kind of revolution and then they become a celebrated hero like right away, usually in their early 20s or even teens. Whereas in reality, when you are, fighting for an artistic revolution of some kind, very often what you accomplish isn't appreciated until long after you're dead. It's gratifying, intriguing, exciting to play one of those people who like causes this artistic revolution, and then also the gratification from the outside of seeing the lack of appreciation that can receive during their own lifetime. In some respects, he was right. he was the first international superstar. So
yeah, Edwin retired from the stage after the unfortunate incident in D.C., and he was gone from the stage for 8 months. During that time, most of his family was placed under arrest. Edwin was the only one with the name of Booth that was not arrested. And it was only because he was Edwin Booth and everyone loved him and revered him. And it's like, no, we know he, of all of the family, had nothing to do with this because most of the family was under arrest for suspicion of conspiracy in the assassination. But he went into seclusion. He went into hiding. He would only go out at night, and he would only go out even at night surrounded by a group of his friends because they feared that someone was going to kill him. And he did receive death threats for the rest of his natural life, that everywhere he went, there would usually be a letter waiting at the theater, or they would arrive at his hotel, and he would open them, and it would be a death threat. And sometimes there would be letters to the editor in newspapers saying, Edwin Booth had better not appear on stage, because if he does, there will be trouble, and how dare he? How dare he perform? So he was in seclusion for 8 months, and when he finally came back, in 1866, he opened with Hamlet, which was his most beloved role and the one that people really wanted to see him in. And he was afraid that it wasn't going to work, that they were going to boo him from the stage. But according to the accounts, there was a 5-minute ovation when the curtain came up and discovers the character of Hamlet on stage during the coronation, waiting for the king and queen to enter. There was a 5-minute ovation, which at first he thought was booing, but they were applauding, and it went on, according to people who were there, for 5 minutes. And he never acknowledged applause from the house, but according to the stories, he looked up, and they could see that his eyes were filled with tears, and he nodded his head and then dropped his gaze again and waited for the play to continue. And then never looked back, you know, continued to perform. But no one was allowed to speak his brother's name in his presence. And if someone did, tried to ask a question or involve him in a conversation, he would abruptly leave the room, and that person would never be allowed anywhere near him ever again. It was a burden that he continually carried.
And which we will see played out in some way.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because you can't bring Johnny on stage and not have both the audience and all the characters on stage aware. This play takes place in 1879, and Johnny died in 1865. So there's a whole long history of just carrying that big, big vault of silence around with you, the things we do not speak.
Angela Iannone is an actor and playwright. Her play, This Prison Where I Live, is currently on stage in the theater space in the Big Red Church on 10th in Wisconsin. It's produced by Milwaukee's Theater Red.
Jared McDerris plays Edwin Booth, and Corey Jefferson Hagen plays John Wilkes Booth. There's more information about the play at WUWM.com.
As Harley riders descend on Milwaukee, we'll talk with a rider whose historic bike and its Milwaukee pilgrimage came earlier this summer. That's when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thousands upon thousands of Harley-Davidson motorcycle riders are on their way to Milwaukee this week for Harley's 115th anniversary celebration. But one Harley rider will not be here. Christophe de Goulain and his 1918 Harley-Davidson are in Las Vegas, another stop on an epic road trip for the historic bike.
De Goulain and his friend Pierre Lauverjat restored the 100-year-old motorcycle they found in France and brought it to the U.S. for a months-long road trip to commemorate the end of World War I. Their trip did include a few days in Wisconsin last month, and I met up with De Goulain at the Harley-Davidson Museum, where he shared the journey of the motorcycle and its sidecar.
Well, it's an incredible story because this bike is 100 years old. This bike arrived in France in 1918 with an American soldier to liberate France and Europe. It has just spent 100 years in France, and for the first time she's back in America, so it's her birthday. It's a very special day, especially being here in Milwaukee.
Do you have a general idea of where it spent the last 100 years since the end of World War I?
We do not know exactly where. I know I found it. It was a barn find 10 years ago. It was a fantastic day for me, the day I found her, but she was in a very poor condition. It needed 9 months work to put it all together and make it safe to ride. And that's my friend Pierre Lauverjat, who did all that job, and we are together touring around America.
You said it took quite a lot of work to get it into this condition. Had he or you ever done quite this extensive an amount of work on a motorcycle before?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to ride a vintage motorcycle, you need to know what's going on inside. They do break down, but they never let you on the side of the road for a long time. We had a lot of little breakdown all the way coming from Mobile, Alabama. Every time we could repair on the side of the road, or we had the help from Harley-Davidson people, the dealer, especially the one from Jacksonville, who have been helpful, and we stayed there 8 days.
I imagine Harley-Davidson was excited to hear about this project.
Yes, well, very much. I mean, Harley-Davidson is a huge company, motorcycle all around the world. People with this passion, and straight away we had contact with the Harley-Davidson Museum. They said, well, what a fantastic things. Will you be coming? Yes, we will be coming with the bike. Will it be on the road yet? We will ride the bike to Milwaukee.
The end of World War I was 100 years ago, and I think people in the United States know about World War I, but they probably don't appreciate just how alive that history still is in France. This is something that is everywhere you go in France.
Of course. I mean, the First World War is a human disaster. The end of this disaster is with the help of America. You have in France a lot of towns, cities, village where you have got American cemetery. We call this Pike Bonny. That's the name of a village where 1844 American soldier died. And it's a very, very strong emotion because when you see the dates on the white marble cross, you know, American soldiers were young. They died for the freedom of a country which was not their country. So we have to respect that and never forget. So Bonny is there to remember. And there is a lot of people who don't know about First World War and don't know about Second World War, but America was there to help us. And thank you, America.
Have you been getting a lot of questions about this bike as you've ridden it around the United States?
Well, it's incredible. If we stop in the middle of nowhere, 5 minutes later, someone stops. First, they say, do you need some help? Well, I appreciate that because it's not in every country. And then after they have the story and they think, well, it's incredible. And we are very, very proud as French Harley-Davidson fanatic to be riding this Harley-Davidson. It's just a dream. It's a lifetime road trip. We are now after a month's trip. We have another 2 months trip and we are going to California. It's a dream. I mean, we will never forget what's happening now in America.
Do you have a newer Harley-Davidson at home in France?
I've got two other Harley-Davidson, which are 1927 and 1929. But since I'm here, yes, I want to buy a brand new Harley-Davidson. I saw them. I've been riding them. They have got the same passion. Harley-Davidson stays Harley-Davidson, even if it's 115 years. It's incredible. I love Harley.
What is it that Harley is an iconic American brand. What is it that, as a Frenchman, appealed so strongly to you about Harley-Davidson?
Well, if you are in France, you see a lot of people ride Harley-Davidson. That's like in all over the world. So it's a bit of the American dream on our French road. It's a culture. And I think Harley-Davidson brings this American culture all over the world. So we heard a lot of things about tax and things like that. So please, Harley-Davidson, please, Europe, don't put any tax on Harley-Davidson. We need them for happiness.
What was the process to get this bike to the United States from France? You can't just bring it on an airplane, I imagine.
No, that was very complicated. Repairing the Harley was complicated, but bringing it to America was complicated. We had the help from the Propeller Club, which are all over the world, in the Sea World. We had then after the Airbus company, which allowed the bike to be in a ship between France and Mobile, Alabama. Then we had question of insurance, have it legal. Well, we did all that, so it's possible. It's not easy, but I mean, for Bonny, it was important to do it. So there's no problem.
Were there any special permits that you had to obtain to be able to drive this on American roads?
It's an American motorcycle, so it was born in America, so it's absolutely legal in America. Just the insurance, which is very important. We had one company who did it.
It does not look very comfortable.
Yeah, well, it's not very comfortable, but you forget that by the pleasure of riding it. So, and we are also two riders, Pierre and I. The sidecar is very comfortable, but I mean, you don't care, you know. It's you cruise along, you know, small roads. You have a break. When you're tired, you know, or you just stop and you talk with people, and it's fine like this.
The idea of the road trip is a very important one to many Americans. Do French people have the same love for getting out on the open road?
Oh yes. I mean, especially for bikers, you know, or any biker likes to jump on his bike and go for a trip. So it's the same.
I have to ask, as I look at all of these other bikes, almost all of them have windshields. What is it like? How do you protect your face when you're spending that long a stretch on the road and you have nothing in front of your face?
Well, we have got the helmet, of course, but the speed, the usual speed of our motorcycle is 45 miles an hour. So the wind is just, there's no problem with the wind.
I feel like I should have you give me a tour of the bike, actually.
The bike is absolutely original. It had some paint put back on it. But here, if you see the saddle, the leather saddle, it's 100 years old. So we know that the American soldiers sat on this saddle. Piston, cylinder, all the metalwork, the wheels, the spoke, the sidecar. This is all original, made in Milwaukee by Harley Davidson. So. It's great. We have got a modern light here because we need the good efficient light in the night. And this is the only thing which is different. And we have got the two flags here in the front on the mudguard, flag of France and America. Here we have got this is very important for us also, because we have the United States World War I Centennial Commission, who gave us all their help, their enthusiasm, and which are following us. We have got also the Mission Centenaire, which is for France. We have, of course, the
two spare tires,
this to cover the sidecar. This is very French. On the sidecar mudguards, we have the joueur de pétanque. So you can't see it on the radio, but the people who know what pétanque is in France will recognize that. Here we have got Daffy, our sponsor, we have got stickers, and of course we have got the Harley Davidson. Wherever we stop in a Harley Davidson dealer, they give us a sticker and we put it on the sidecar, and we are very proud to tour then after with the sticker.
What has been the most memorable part of the trip so far for you?
I think arriving here in Milwaukee. I mean, we just arrived a quarter of an hour ago to see the Harley Davidson Museum. In front of me, me on the bike with Pierre. I mean, this is, that was the dream. So we are very, very happy.
Is it a little like a pilgrimage?
Yes, yes. No, it's, I mean, there's no word to say it. I would be able to talk about this in French for hours. In English, maybe it's more difficult, but it's a very, very strong emotion.
Joie de vivre, mate.
Joie de vivre.
Well, merci beaucoup. Bon voyage.
Merci beaucoup et à bientôt. Et suivez-nous sur Twin Links so you can follow our trip on our Facebook page, which is called Twin Links.
Merci.
Merci.
Frenchman Christophe Degoulin and Pierre Lauverjat are driving a 1918 Harley-Davidson motorcycle around the United States to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. We spoke with them at the Harley-Davidson Museum last month. According to their trip's Facebook page, they have made it to Las Vegas.
You can see pictures of the bike and the sidecar and find a link to follow their journey at WUWM.com.
Glenn Janson passed away this week. Janson was a professor emeritus of history at UW-Milwaukee. The Louisiana native was the author of a number of books on subjects ranging from presidents, politics, and movies.
He spoke in 2016 with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about his book on Herbert Hoover's legacy and why he thought we should all take a closer look at that presidency.
Well, first of all, he wasn't a do-nothing president. He was an activist president. He was the most activist president during hard times of any president up to that time. And he had the most complete schedule of bills he wanted passed, most of them which were passed, of any president up to that time, with the possible exception of Woodrow Wilson's first term. Hoover liked the work of the presidency. He didn't like campaigning for it. He was shy and introverted, which isn't rare among Quakers. But I think so many of the ideas for the New Deal came from Hoover's administration that we ought to be well aware of that. I mean, we've come to consider with the civil rights movement and other things I lived through that discrimination and harsh criticism and blame are often unmerited, and at any time they're inappropriate. And if we can learn that one lesson from Hoover's experience and how badly he was hurt by it, and he was a man of strong feelings. He didn't always show them, especially publicly, but he felt it, and it hurt. And Hoover had a lot of integrity as well. The reason he wrote his own speeches, he was the last president to do that, is because he felt that parroting ghostwritten speeches was immoral, was not being honest. And his wife, Lou Henry, also gave hundreds of speeches, and she wrote all of her own speeches. And he had a second career as a writer. He had a very inventive mind. At one time, he was one of the highest paid engineers in the world. At one time, he was the best known humanitarian in the world. And I don't want all of that to get lost in the maze of Hoover's being blamed for the Depression. Anybody that would have been president then would have undergone that. Anybody that would have been president when World War II came would have gotten credit for ending it. So I guess I'm trying to desimplify things to make them a little more complicated and more realistic, to erase some of those stereotypes. And stereotypes of anybody are not good. They're not good when they're used racially or ethnically, but they're not good when they're applied to Hoover either. And that's what we have even in most history books today. My interest in Hoover goes back a long way. When I was a graduate student at Florida State University, one of the first courses I took was in U.S. history, 1921 to 45. And I asked my teacher if I could do something on the Hoover administration. And he said no, because nothing happened. So I went ahead and I wrote my paper on the Hoover administration, and I filled it, packed it with facts and legislation that was passed and things that were done to create jobs. He was the greatest conservationist president since Theodore Roosevelt. And when we got the papers back, my teacher wrote on it A+. This was the best paper in class. I learned a lot about Hoover. And I guess I'm still trying to do that.
Glenn Johnson speaking with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in 2016 about his book Herbert Hoover, A Life. Johnson, a professor emeritus at UW-Milwaukee, passed away this week. He was 71. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.